Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Austin Peterson here, former presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party. Today is Wednesday, April the 19th, and today it's going to be a good day. You don't have to use your AK. Do me a favor. Check out my interview coming out today on the Rubin Report. After the podcast is over, there should be a YouTube link most likely posted on my Facebook page today. I think you guys are really going to enjoy that conversation. So don't forget, after this podcast is over, to go over to my Facebook page and check out the interview with the Rubin Report. Or you can just go to his YouTube page as well, the Rubin Report, Dave Rubin, and check out my interview over there. Today's topic is one that I think you'll find very interesting. We're going to talk about how liberals, specifically liberal comedians, led to the rise of Donald Trump. But before we do, first, a word from our sponsors. As innovators in credit repair, My Credit Dreams helps clarify credit reporting errors. MyCreditDreams.com is fast, friendly, and efficient. No subscription is necessary, and there's a money-back guarantee in the contract. Visit MyCreditDreams.com or call 972-900-7777. Visit MyCreditDreams.com and schedule your free consultation today. Welcome back to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Have you guys noticed that we have been doing a lot more of these audio podcasts lately? Now, I know some people have complained that we haven't done the video podcast as much lately, but there's actually a pretty good reason for that. And capitalism has brought you to me today because we have been picking up some sponsorships for the audio podcast, which is really exciting because if you hadn't noticed, we were doing maybe a podcast a week because we didn't have any sponsors for the show. So of course, when you're not getting paid for something, it's a lot harder to do it. One of the reasons why we do the audio and the video shows is it sort of operates as a loss leader, which, if you're not familiar with industry terms, a loss leader is like a product or an item that you use to try and bring people in, essentially. So the idea is the way that the Libertarian Republic works and Liberty Viral works is that we make money off of the advertising on our website. But it's much harder to get advertisements for your podcast, audio podcasts like this. And so we do these audio podcasts and video podcasts, not because we make any money on them, because until recently we really haven't, but they operate essentially as a loss leader to get people to come to the website so that hopefully they'll read some articles, maybe click on some ads, maybe buy some products from our website ads, so that we can stay in business and bring you more liberty-loving news every single day. But recently we've had a big development, and we've been picking up sponsors in this audio show, and it's fantastic. If you've been a longtime listener of the Freedom Report podcast, we've been going almost in business for 3 years. I can't believe it. It's really exciting because, you know, you see so many people doing podcasts and different things like that, and generally they tend to be a labor of love. But when you start to build up an audience, as such as we have here at the Freedom Report, then you start to attract the attention of advertisers, which is great, because what that means is more Freedom Report audio podcasts for you, because I got to produce more shows to fit in the ads, and everybody wins, right? That's a really good thing for everyone. And so, yeah, so a loss leader is generally that thing that you lose money on so that you can get people in. Another perfect example is that Walmart does this. If you didn't know, Walmart actually sells their toys, many of their toys, for cheaper than, a lot of times, cheaper than what they buy them for. And the reason why is, and they call those loss leaders, is because they lose money on it, but it brings you into the Walmart store so that while you're buying, you know, the My Little Pony or whatever for your teenage son who's, a pony guy, whatever they they're brony, if he's a brony, then you're going to possibly buy a spatula or a microwave or something like that. And that's how that works. But every once in a while, a loss leader will suddenly turn into a win leader, right? It's great news for us, and I'm very grateful for you all for helping to make this show the success that it's become, because wow, we've a million listeners a month is nothing to sneeze at. So again, thanks very much for being a listener, a loyal listener to the Freedom Report podcast. As always, you can find us on iTunes or on Stitcher, and we do stream these on Facebook Live as well. So if you're listening on Facebook, then I'm very grateful to you as well. Do us a favor, give us a share. Okay, so on topic, the big story for today, the one that I thought was an absolutely brilliant article that I wanted to share with you all today, is written by a liberal, and it's how late night comedy fueled the rise of Trump. And I changed the title of this podcast a little bit just so it makes it a little bit more appealing to you all. But the article that comes in the May 2017 issue of The Atlantic has a subtitle that says, "Sneering hosts have alienated conservatives and made liberals smug." And it's got a picture of a guy who looks like, not Trevor Noah, but the other liberal, smug liberal host. What's the guy's name? Colbert, the Colbert Report guy. Stephen Colbert. And he's giving a noogie to a guy with a Make America Great Again shirt on. And it's just a perfect comic to go along with this story. But, how rare is it to see liberals being self-reflecting? And so this article is probably one of the most beautiful pieces that I have read in weeks. So I definitely wanted to share it with you all and discuss it. And thanks so much, Jesse Bennett, for bringing it to my attention this morning. So let's get into it. A month after the election, Trevor Noah, the host of The Daily Show, published an op-ed in the New York Times that sought to position himself and his show as instruments of healing in a broken land. Now, that's a really interesting little point there, and I have a story to go along with that in just a moment. It was called "Let's Not Be Divided. Divided people are easier to rule." And it zapped around progressives' inboxes and Facebook feeds like a digital balm of Gilead. It was a reminder that we were not, in those fevered early weeks, being our best selves. Quote, "Instead of speaking in measured tones about what unites us, we are screaming at each other about what divides us." How true that was, and, one might churlishly observe, what a sea change from Noah's tone during the campaign, when he berated the Republican candidate for tweeting with those fat little tiny fingers of yours, and for trying to think with that stupid head, and when he advised the candidate that maybe you should look in the mirror, a-hole. This combination of sentiments, the excoriating, profanity-strewn, ad hominem tirade against the president, and by extension against anyone who might agree in any small measure with his actions, and the saintly appeal for reaching out to the other side, dominates the political discussion inside the blue bubble these days. The excoriating outweighs the reaching out at a ratio of about 20 to 1. But the earnestly expressed desire for a more humane form of discourse is enduring. The late-night political comedy shows, principally Noah's Daily Show, Samantha Bee's Full Frontal, and John Oliver's Last Week Tonight, staked their territory during the heat of the general election. Unwavering, bombastic, belittling, humiliating screeds against Donald Trump. Fair enough. Trump is a man who on any casual summer day during the campaign could be found inciting a crowd to violence. This isn't the slippery slope. This is the ditch at the bottom of the hill. Once a man stands before a mob and exhorts the powerful to beat the outlier, it's all over except for the cannibalism and the cave painting. Quote, "Government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth," said Abraham Lincoln. "Knock the crap out of them," said Donald Trump. And before I continue on this article, yeah, just very briefly, I was actually slated to be on Samantha Bee's show post-election. Now, I was booked before the election, and the actual piece was supposed to be about uniting our country, bringing us all together, and how we were supposed to have this, we were supposed to have this whole show, and I was supposed to represent the libertarians, come on and talk about, what it meant now that the election was over and that Hillary Clinton was president, except Hillary Clinton isn't the president. And they canceled it. They canceled the show. And I was, of course, disappointed because I was looking forward to getting to take a few jabs at Samantha because she called me a sentient smirk during the LP campaign. When she came to the LP convention, and she's like, "Austin Peterson, sentient smirk, Austin Peterson." Sentient smirk. I'm not quite sure, but it was something like that. But I did think it was funny that they had this whole togetherness, you know, love Trump's hate before the election, and then after it was over, they all went apoplectic, and suddenly no more togetherness, right? So I thought that was interesting. So Trump has it coming. And so do the minions pouring out of his clown car with their lies and their gleeful disregard for what Nick Carraway called the fundamental decencies. But somewhere along the way, the hosts of the late-night shows decided that they had carte blanche to insult not just the people within this administration, but also the ordinary citizens who support Trump, and even those who merely identify as conservatives. In March, Samantha Bee's show issued a formal apology to a young man who had attended the Conservative Political Action Conference and whom the show had blasted for having a, quote, Nazi hair. As it turned out, the young man was suffering from stage 4 brain cancer, which a moment's research on the producer's part would have revealed. He had tweeted about his frightening diagnosis days before the conference. As part of its apology, the show contributed $1,000 to the GoFundMe campaign that is raising money for his medical expenses. So now we know the price of a cancer joke. It was hardly the first time Full Frontal had gone guns blazing after the sick or the meek. During the campaign, B dispatched a correspondent to go shoot fish in a barrel at something called the Western Conservative Summit, which the reporter described as an annual Denver gathering popular with hard-right Christian conservatives. He interviewed an earnest young boy who talked about going to church on Sundays and Bible study on Wednesdays, and about his hope to start a group called Children for Trump. For this, the boy, who spoke with the unguarded openness of a child who has assumed goodwill on the part of an adult, was described as, quote, Jerry Falwell in blonde, larval form. Trump and B are on different sides politically, but culturally, they drink from the same cup, one filled with poisonous nectar of reality TV and its baseless values, which have now moved to the very center of our national discourse. Trump and B share a penchant for verbal cruelty and a willingness to mock the defenseless. Both consider self-restraint, once the hallmark of the admirable, to be for chumps. Yes, yes, I know, she is a comedian, he is the President of the United States. There is no scale by which their words and actions can be reasonably compared. Yet, while for B, as for so many in her field, Michelle Obama's "when they go low, we go high" may have been a ravishing meme, Trump's mockery of a war hero, grieving parents, and a disabled man showed you how to get the job done. When John Oliver told viewers that if they opposed abortion, they had to change the channel until the last minute of the program, when they would be shown an adorable bucket of sloths, he perfectly encapsulated the tone of these shows, one imbued with the conviction that they and their fans are intellectually and morally superior to those who espouse any of the beliefs of the political right. 2 days before the election, every talking head on television was assuring us that Trump didn't have a chance because he lacked a, quote, ground game. After his victory, one had to wonder whether some part of his ground game had been conducted night after night on television, under flattering studio lights, and with excellent production values and comedy writing. Though aimed at blue state sophisticates, these shows are an unintended but powerful form of propaganda for conservatives. When Republicans see these harsh jokes, which echo down through the morning news shows and the chattering day's worth of viral clips, along with those of Jimmy Kimmel, Stephen Colbert, and Seth Meyers, they don't just see a handful of comics mocking them. They see HBO, Comedy Central, TBS, ABC, CBS, and NBC. In other words, they see exactly what Donald Trump has taught them, that the entire media landscape loathes them, their values, their family, and their religion. It is hardly a reach for them to further imagine that the legitimate news shows on the channels are run by similarly partisan players, nor is it at all illogical. No wonder so many of Trump's followers are inclined to believe only the things that he or his spokespeople tell them directly. Everyone else on the tube thinks they're a bunch of trailer park, oxy-snorting half-wits who divide their time between retweeting Alex Jones fantasies and ironing their Klan hoods. Of course, late-night entertainers can hardly be expected to ignore the comedic bounty with which Trump and his henchmen have blessed them. And in this bizarre new political reality, treating Trump the way other presidents have traditionally been treated puts the host in danger of committing the grave sin of, quote, normalizing him, as Jimmy Fallon did last fall. Trump had appeared on Fallon's Tonight Show before the primaries, in September 2015, back when he was still a joke candidate, back when a lighthearted interview with him rang no alarm bells. The two evinced an immediate television rapport. Fallon as a straight man, Trump as the same Trump he's been on television and radio shows for more than three decades. But when Fallon had him on again a year later, the situation was very different. Now, Trump was the Republican nominee, and his bag of tricks, inciting violence in crowds, threatening religious tests, calling the press a pack of liars, was no longer so amusing. Fallon didn't see any need to turn his show into Meet the Press. He leaned toward Trump and said, Donald, I just wanted to ask you if there's something we could do that's just not presidential, really. And then, with his guest permission, if it was a bit, they'd worked it out beforehand, he playfully reached over and mussed up that famous hair. Fallon was lambasted the next day. A tweet from John Lovett, a former speechwriter for Barack Obama, was representative. Quote, "This photo will be in history books, and the caption will not be about how Jimmy Fallon is such a fun, nice guy." And rightly so. By then, Trump had exhibited enough ugly and norm-breaking behavior to have made treating him as a lovable bridge and tunnel celebrity straight out of Queens circa 1975. President Crazy Eddie, President Tom Carvel, beyond the pale. Trump had already revealed himself to be a dangerous person. Perhaps the best thing that can be said about the man is that he let America know exactly what it would be getting if he were elected. It was a huge mistake on Fallon's part, one he's been paying for ever since. His ratings have not recovered from it. One clue to Trump's improbable victory lies in the fact that getting a noogie from a comic on late-night television is now considered a normalizing activity for a presidential candidate. The implication is that you're not fit for executive office unless you can clown for us on the tube when we're half awake. John F. Kennedy was the first candidate to appear on late-night television, visiting Jack Parr's set in 1960. No matter what you think of the short, dangerous presidency of JFK, watching their conversation could bring you to tears. At one point, Parr invites audience members to ask their own questions of the senator. Quote, "Let's have, you know, responsible questions from responsible people," Parr says. "And I waited for a laugh, but it didn't come. It wasn't a joke. This wasn't Judy Garland making eyes at him and telling Lana Turner stories and biting her thumb seductively. This was a chance to interview someone who wanted to be the president, and Parr asked his audience members to act accordingly, which they did. It ended up being a love-in about the commie threat, including certain dark intimations about Southeast Asia, but what are you going to do? Camelot! The new age officially began with Bill Clinton's 1992 appearance on the Arsenio Hall show, playing his saxophone. This wasn't Richard Nixon, too little too late, solemnly playing his own mournful composition on a baby grand piano for Parr in 1963. After losing both the presidential and the California gubernatorial elections, this was, quote, "Heartbreak Hotel." With the audience on their feet, Bubba in shades, Arsenio out of his mind for the power of, quote, "the big man." This was the president as entertainer. The president as a guy so young and cool that he could slide right onto the set of the most with it late night show and sit in with a band. Who couldn't love this guy? Well, possibly the family of Ricky Ray Rector, the retarded man on Arkansas's death row whom Clinton had cruelly allowed to be executed just 5 months earlier to prove he was tough on crime. A pointed question about that bit of horror might have been more instructive to the electorate than the sax solo and Hall's penetrating inquiries about whether Clinton preferred the young Elvis or the old Elvis for a postage stamp. But somewhere along the way, we decided that we wanted the values of a Las Vegas lounge act to become part of our most important civic conversation. So the stunt, the shtick, the mildly embarrassing question, soon President Bubba, well on his way to re-election, would be telling an MTV crowd whether he wore boxers or briefs, became an essential campaign feature, and now we have a reality TV star for president. You could argue that by giving Trump a noogie, Fallon did the responsible thing. He subjected the man to one of the requisite tests of fitness for office. We created our own black hole, and we collapsed into it. Trump's appearance with Fallon may mark a moment in our national story. It was the last fleeting glimmer of anything approaching goodwill, and possibly of anything deserving it, between political factions. Since then, it's been a race to the bottom, as the crudeness of the president is matched by that of the resistance, with all of us being judged by how well, how thoroughly, and consistently and elaborately we can hate each other. Nothing about this time is elevating. It's just all of us, on the left and the right, sworn to our bitterness and our anger. As I embarked on writing this essay, Trump had just made what was then the latest in his endless series of preposterous moves. He had tweeted, without evidence but with certainty, that Trump Tower had been wiretapped by Barack Obama in the final days of the campaign. In the range of things Trump is capable of saying, doing, or tweeting, this was not big league. It was just another day at batting practice. But the episode was one more stunning reminder of how this impulsive, self-obsessed leader who holds grudges and appoints his own family members to substantive positions is making America into a laughingstock around the world. We are a country with the greatest creed in all of history, the Constitution of the United States, yet we are looking more and more like a banana republic. I've thought about that a lot, but I've also thought a good deal about the boy on Samantha Bee's program. I thought about the moment her producer approached the child's mother to sign a release, so that the woman's young son could be humiliated on television. Was it a satisfying moment, or was it accompanied by a small glint of recognition that embarrassing children is a crappy way to make a living? I thought about the boy waiting eagerly to see himself on television, feeling a surge of pride that he'd talked about church and Bible study. And I thought about the moment when he realized that it had all been a trick, that the grown-up, who had seemed so nice, had only wanted to hurt him. My God, I thought, what have we become? I don't know that there's anything more that I can add to that piece, as powerful as it is. I could go through and point some of the areas of disagreement, but for the most part, I think I need to let some works stand on their own. A beautiful piece by Caitlin Flanagan at The Atlantic. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to the Freedom Report podcast today. Do me a favor, give us a share if you're listening on Facebook Live right now. Click the share button and share this story with your friends. If you'd like to be able to download and listen to our show at any time, you can do so at iTunes or on Stitcher, the Stitcher app. But you know what? The best app to use this on is actually the Podbean app itself, where the Freedom Report lives. So after this is over, if you'd like to be able to get these shows on the go, go to podbean.com. That's P-O-D-B-E-A-N, podbean.com. And click to subscribe to the Freedom Report, so every time we upload a show, you'll get one. Ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful day.